Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. In Washington, David Gura.
Tom, thank you very much. Joined here by the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee. That is Megan Berry. She's here for a Smart Cities event at our Bloomberg government office. Great to have you
with
us. I'm going to moderate a panel with six mayors, so it's a pleasure to talk to you one-on-one. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, good luck.
Help us with a definition, first of all. We talk about smart cities. What are we talking about?
Well, you're talking about lots of different things. I mean, for us, it's about transit and how you build in that smart technology in all the transit that you have going on. So we're really focused right now on just the basic things, like getting our signals timed. I mean, that makes a city smart, but it's the more comprehensive visionary stuff like AV, automated vehicles, and those, how we're all going to get around cities in the future.
How much of that is elective? In other words, is there a need for Nashville to move in this direction, or is it something you would like to see?
Oh, no, we need to move. I mean, we are so far behind in transit. I mean, you walk around in New York and D.C. and you see these incredible transit infrastructures. We don't have any of that. So we're really at the very beginning of building that infrastructure out. We've got bus systems, but we need light rail. We need passenger rail. We need a whole bunch of much more comprehensive infrastructure.
How do you assess the appetite for that? You've got citizens who may want this. They're going to have to pay for at least some of it.
Right.
How do you know what's a good investment? I'm from Chapel Hill, and there's been talk for a long time about building light rail between Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh. It's something that people maybe have their eye on, but then when they see the cost of it, they blanch a little bit. How do you pick the projects that are worthwhile for the citizens of Nashville?
So what we look at is where are active riderships and where can we actually put transit down on the line. And I will tell you right now, with the growth of Nashville, 81 people a day are moving to Nashville. So you feel that crunch. Our roads just can't take the capacity anymore. So we've got to be more creative. And that's what being smart's all about.
You're here in Washington, D.C. Yes, we're gonna do a panel. You're also going to be on Capitol Hill. What role do you see the federal government playing? We heard the president in a speech to a joint session of Congress saying he wants $1 trillion in infrastructure spending, public-private partnerships, and the like. What role should the federal government be playing in doing that?
Well, I hope that that's the case. I'd love to see that $1 trillion make its way to Nashville. We'll take just a piece of it.
Not even a big piece, just a little piece.
I think the federal government has to be a critical partner, but I think that local municipalities can't wait anymore. I think that there used to be a time when the feds would say, hey, here's a pot of money. I think now locals have to come and say, we've got this. We've got some money to put in ourselves. Let's find a way to make this all happen together.
How much of a challenge is getting private sector investment into infrastructure projects? Is that something that you're looking at? Is it something that, what's the case that you make to investors to put money in toward Nashville?
So as we begin those conversations about how we're going to fund our $6 billion transit plan, P3s are critical. Yeah. And I think that we are seeing other places where you've got private investment that wants to flow in. We are actually, my vernacular is a little different. We call them private public partnerships.
In that order.
Yes, because there's going to probably be a lot more private money in this than public.
Still three Ps.
Three Ps, yes, three Ps, but the order matters.
The dialogue here is between you and other mayors from around the country. How much of what you're doing is pulling stuff that's tried and true in other places, bringing it to Nashville? How much are you looking for things that are replicatable?
We're looking for anything. We don't think that we have to have pride of ownership. We're all about trying to find something that's already worked and taking it. And the good thing about local municipalities and mayors in particular is we want to share. So I was recently in Denver with the mayor of Mayor Hancock, mm-hmm. looking at their transit system and learning from what they've done. And the thing is, those that have come before, you can also learn from their mistakes.
Yeah.
So we really want to share with each other, and I think that's really, really critical.
You mentioned the degree to which Nashville is growing. What's your vision for what that city looks like in 10, 20 years time? It's going to be bigger.
It's going to be bigger.
How's it going to be different just in terms of getting around or what's going to be there?
Well, I mean, I think when you think about Nashville, one of our best pieces is that we are attracting incredible talent. We are attracting a diverse talent pool. And we want to be able to make sure that they want to stay and be able to get around really easily. And not having that traffic that every day in, it's going to make a huge difference to their quality of life.
I just ask you about legacy. I was talking with Tom, my co-host, a little while back. The mayor of New Bedford's going to be here. You think of New Bedford, you think of fishing. You think of Nashville, you think of music. As you look at the future of the city, How do you deal with that legacy, being associated with something but wanting the city to stand for something more? Have other industry come in, for example?
Well, you know, music is a huge part of what Nashville, music, you know, our economy, but we're also a huge healthcare capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have one of the things that made us actually very strong through the recession was that we have a very diverse economic engine. So, continuing to grow that, making sure we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket, but at the same time, music is what makes us special.
Yeah.
And you never want to lose that.
Let me ask you lastly here, we've got about 30 seconds left, how you assess what works. So you invest in something, you try something different. How much time do you give that? How do you look at the data and see what's working and what's not?
Well, first of all, you actually said the key word, which is data.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the past we've just thrown things down and said, let's just cross our fingers. Now we actually have taken a long time to study and find out where the ridership is, especially for these mass transit projects, and we've got the data. So we're at least starting a little bit ahead. Now the success will be if people ride it.
Megan Berry, thank you very much for joining us here at the Bloomberg Smart Cities event. That gets started in just a little while here. The mayor of Nashville joining me. David Gura here in Washington, as you said, with Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty. She's a congresswoman from the 5th District in Connecticut. We were just talking with the mayor of Nashville about her ambitions for making Nashville a smart city, and she talked a little bit about the degree to which she's relying on the federal government to help her in those efforts. You're on Capitol Hill, where there has been talk of infrastructure spending, a new infrastructure package. Where do things stand? Just give us the state of play at this point. Suffice to say, it's a busy agenda on Capitol Hill at this point.
It's a busy agenda, and this is an area where there's enormous interest in bipartisan support. There isn't a district, a congressional district in America, there isn't a state that isn't in need of infrastructure, whether it's new infrastructure for growing cities. You take some, I know you'll be talking to the mayor of Charlotte soon, or the industrial Northeast, where I live, which I represent, Waterbury, Connecticut, and areas like that, or the industrial Midwest, we all need infrastructure. And so that should provide the pressure. The challenge that we're facing is how do we finance it? And that's really what we're looking at right now. Lots of different proposals. The president's put $1 trillion price tag, so has Chuck Schumer. In the House, we've got, I would say, more actionable plans that we put forward. And we're going to now try to move them forward.
You know, we talk about tax reform, and the blueprint from which we're working is this Ryan Brady blueprint. Is there something similar for infrastructure spending at this point? In other words, you have people making proposals, but is there a piece of legislation, no matter how inchoate, from which lawmakers are working at this point, or are we not there yet?
We're not really there yet, although there are a couple of different proposals. Most folks think we're likely to see some form of repatriation of overseas profits, of which we're looking at trillions of dollars, which could provide the corpus from which we could then do a major infrastructure bank, for example. That needs to be part of the deal, but as you can imagine, other people have designs on that money, too. And so I don't think Chairman Brady is, nor Speaker Ryan, my workout buddy Speaker Ryan, are quite yet ready to agree to that. So that's basically what we've got, the order we have. We have first coming health care to free up money for tax reform.
Yeah.
And only then are we going to get to infrastructure. So that's really the hang up right now, is that ordering is making it hard for us to come to an agreed upon deal.
Here with Congresswoman Esty at the Bloomberg Smart Cities event, and it's a casual freewheeling space. The mayor of Columbus has just shown up, Andrew Ginter, who joins us here on Bloomberg Surveillance. Talking about the role that the federal government might play, your city was a bona fide smart city, granted a lot of money by the federal government as part of a competition. How has that money helped you move your city forward? What sort of work did that competition do to get you to where you want to be?
Well, we're working on it.
You're
we're
working
not there
on it.
Yet.
Yeah.
We were just awarded a year ago, and very pleased with the way the community has responded. We started with a $40 million award from DOT, $10 million from Vulcan. At the time we were awarded, we had about $90 million of local match, public-private entities locally that were matched up into this acceleration fund. And now we're at $367 million total, and we've just set a goal of $1 billion by 2020. So what you're really starting to see is some of the pilots that we had in place for our proposal really hitting the ground in neighborhoods like Linden, one of our neighborhoods with highest levels of incarceration, infant mortality, unemployment, and poverty, to really start to open up more modes of safe, reliable transportation to jobs, affordable, high-quality child care, job training, workforce development. That's what this is all about. I really believe that mobility is the great equalizer of the 21st century, and that's why it's so important. So to have allies with vision like Congresswoman here and others, we're spending some time here in Washington talking about what we're doing with Smart Columbus and ask for continued commitment and investment into intelligent transportation for the future.
Congressman Massey, how much of a dialogue is there between the federal government and the local government? How could you do more to understand what's working and what's not here in Washington?
Well, I do a great deal with my own districts. Neil O'Leary, who's mayor of Waterbury, is very involved in the Smart Cities. They've applied for a Smart Cities grant. And I couldn't agree more with the mayor here about we really do need to have mobility. And sometimes this gets hung up about, is it jobs, shovel-ready jobs right now? But it's jobs into the future. It's jobs right now and into the future. So I look at challenges we have, for example, with access to community colleges. Mm. Well, that is dependent on having a bus service. The folks who use community college need night buses. Mm-hmm. And we've had struggles over that, and that's why I'm so enthusiastic about things like the Smart Cities projects. Cities are places, and having represented a local community, the rubber hits the road. You got to fix the pothole. You have to deliver services. You can't be an ideologue. Nobody cares what letters after your name if you're a mayor. Are you getting the job done? And I know that from my time doing that. That's why I want to see these laboratories, not just of the states, but the laboratories of the cities, which where more people are living more and more in our cities. Let them use these projects, show what works, and then we do more of what works and less of what doesn't.
Congressman Massey, thank you very much. Thanks to you, Mayor Gittner, as well. And we're going to be on stage in just a little while. Let you guys get breakfast first before I tackle some panels on stage. I'm here at the Bloomberg Government Smart Cities event in Washington, D.C. Too short a visit with these two.
I just want to get the statehood question out of the way. And Charlie, being from New York, had no idea. So I'm going to let you explain that.
Sure. So we have been on a quest to make D.C. equal to every other state in America, and actually Washingtonians, who are taxpayers, equal to every other American. And that's what we've been focused on in the district. We are a city, county, and state all at once, except we have no vote in the Congress of the United States, the only capital in the world where its citizens don't have representatives in the Congress. So we have presented a bill to the Congress to change that. Mm-hmm. Last year, over 80% of Washingtonians voted to become the 51st state, and the Congress can make this change by a simple vote.
A large percentage of D.C. residents also voted for Hillary Clinton to be president, and Donald Trump is our president. Historically, D.C. does not fare as well for local control under Republican administration. So given this, is D.C. statehood right now a pipe dream?
Well, actually, that's not the case. In the district, our congresswoman and leaders of the District of Columbia have worked with Republicans and Democrats alike to advance issues that help Washingtonians. We have had Republicans, including the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, vote to have Washingtonians to have a vote in the Congress, to have a delegate have a vote. So for us, this is not a Republican or Democratic issue. It's an issue that's very central to our American democracy. If you pay taxes, you get a vote in representation in the Congress.
Now, you are here because of Smart Cities and to talk about infrastructure. I wanted to get an idea about that, particularly when you think about Metro and all of the problems that it's had of late. What are some of the best practices that you're able to take away from this and to present to this conference?
I always like to be with other mayors to see what they're working on. We had a great conversation about how USDOT can be involved. There's a discussion about the need for the reauthorization of a federal transportation Act, which we're very focused on as well. In the district, of course, we function as city, county, and state, so we have all of those roles, and we work with the region, with Maryland and Virginia, because we're metro funders. So we like to see a big move that President promised for a big infrastructure bill, and hopefully the money to go with it, to make the necessary investments, because we have them too. We have them in transit, we have them in roads, and we have them in bridges.
You and Amy both make the point that that this is a cross-state issue. In terms of being a smart city as D.C., what are some of the challenges in working with your neighbors to make sure that you're all pursuing these goals mutually?
Well, I think that the biggest issue that we have is Metro, because it is by a compact operated by Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. Except when it was created more than 40 years ago now, there was not a regional funding mechanism put in place. And there's no other transit system like ours in the United States that doesn't, all of those systems have a dedicated funding source. And that's what we're very focused on.
Other parts of infrastructure could include anything from cyber to handling the homeless. What are some of the big initiatives that's facing D.C. right now?
Well, housing. We include housing certainly in all of our infrastructure ask. The federal government has a role. They have some public housing in Washington. But we are also making a $100 million investment in our housing production trust fund each and every year. And that puts us in tops across the country in the amount that we're investing in affordable housing. We are particularly concerned about some housing that have affordability covenants now that will expire over the next several years. So part of our efforts are around preservation of those 8,000 units.
One of the issues that a lot of mayors are struggling with where you have had medical or recreational marijuana initiatives is federal, state, city jurisdiction. How is D.C.'s marijuana, recreational marijuana use allowance faring under the Jeff Sessions Justice Department?
Well, we per se don't have legalization of recreational marijuana, and this is confusing, so let me explain. First of all, we do have a medical marijuana regime that's been in place for a number of years, which I understand people are also questioning the use of medical marijuana. A couple of years ago, our voters approved a measure to allow for the use of marijuana by adults in the possession of marijuana in their private homes.
For recreational use.
Yes, for non-medical use.
Part of your function.
What's different, though, and the reason why I point this out is in states where marijuana is legalized, they have a regime that allows for the growing and procurement and sale of marijuana. That's not the case in the district.
So how does that mesh with the federal government's position?
Well,
which is
marijuana
to get tough on drugs.
Illegal, according to it. It is part of the I forget the word that they use, but the medical use of marijuana is not approved on the federal schedule. So any marijuana regime, whether it's medical or recreational, if there's a change in federal policy to enforce those crimes, it will have an effect on any state that has a medical or recreational program.
As we are talking about the smart cities and the infrastructure, how fast is D.C. growing, and where do you see the district in the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, we grow about 900 people per month. We've been on that pace for, I think, the last 5 years.
Is that sustainable?
Yes, it is. But we have to make a lot of investments in transportation and housing. Where the biggest pinch that we have is on housing. And we're starting to see it in other things that people need associated with housing, like childcare.
And who are those 900 people? How are the demographics of the city changing?
Well, they've changed. I think that probably the biggest change is that they're very young. You heard one of the mayor say a little bit earlier that her city is half of the people that her city grows by are millennials. I will say it's much significantly higher for D.C., that most of the people moving here are under the age of 35. We are also see people who are downsizing that are moving from the suburbs to the district.
Mayor, I know that your time is short. I know we have to let you go. I just want to talk to you about priorities. How do you prioritize, and how do you figure out how to pay for it as you get into the infrastructure of the nation's capital?
Well, I'm just going to talk to you about one new effort we have, and that's around, of course, we're making the necessary investments in Metro, and we're seeking to get a dedicated funding source, and we're encouraging our neighbors in Maryland and Virginia to join us. But we're also doing some back to the basics things in our city when it comes to infrastructure. I have a state of good repair plan in my current budget for all residential streets in D.C. We do pretty well on our main arterials. Only 7% of them are in poor condition, but that number goes up to 30% when you're talking about residential streets. So I have a five-year plan to get rid of poorly rated roads in the district, and that's very important. We're also very focused on, as you've heard, on making our city more resilient when it comes to flooding and the like. So I would say transportation and housing are our top two infrastructure issues.
So, Mayor Roberts, we're at the Smart Cities meeting. You hear about smart this and smart that all the time. How do you use data and transparency, which are themes of this conference, to create a smart city?
Well, you can have data usage in many different areas of what cities worry about and what they focus on every day. What we've really looked at in Charlotte is how do we use data to make sure that we're serving everyone, that we're being equitable in our infrastructure, and that we're connecting people to jobs, to healthcare, to even healthy food as part of the inequalities we see in our communities. And so when you have data where you know where people are working, where they're living, which bus routes connect them, do those bus routes work, do those transit connections work, how do the roadways work, when you have that accurate data, you can make sure that not just is the government operating efficiently, but also individual folks who are just living their lives in your community are operating efficiently as well. And that helps with the quality of life. It also helps to eliminate some of the disparities in income and access, other challenges that rapidly growing cities face all across America.
And when you're talking about transit infrastructure in particular, I know you were specifically speaking about bus routes. Are there other issues, transit infrastructure issues, or possibilities that Charlotte's looking toward? And what are your priorities? And how will you pay for them? That's all packed in one package right there.
And I only get 3 minutes to answer that?
As long as you want.
Well, the funding is a challenge. And I think what we look at, we have a very successful light rail that we're extending to our university, which is great because it will connect UNC Charlotte to our downtown. That's going to be 10 miles added to the 10 miles already there. We have a streetcar system. And we have three more lines that are under study that we know where those corridors are going to be. But that additional total is going to be about $6 billion.
Wow.
And right now we don't have funding in place. We're waiting to hear from the federal government to whether they're going to continue the Tiger program and other things that we have used successfully to start that light rail system that we have going. And what we find is it's not just about transportation, it's also about land use. And it's about how you grow your city and how you plan your city so that when you can put density along those corridors, you're much more efficient at getting people to work, getting people to the doctor, et cetera, and also leaving room for some open space for those big parks and those greenways and things that you need to help that balance and that quality of life and to help your environment. And so funding is a key part of that. But we're also looking at the range of options because we know that half the folks moving to Charlotte every day are under age 35. We know they don't like cars. So I've heard them in many forums and community meetings. They want a bike. They want to go transit. They want to Uber. So we want to make sure that we're expanding our bike paths. We want to make sure that we're doing mixed-use development so they can actually walk a lot of places. We see a lot of folks walking to breweries. That's another big booming industry in Charlotte, the microbreweries.
Really?
Absolutely. We have like 21 of them within a mile of uptown. It's incredible. And people want to walk to those. They don't want to have to worry about driving after that. So they also want to have the social life that goes with that and people being out. We have this whole group of cyclists who meet on every Tuesday night. They're like 100 of them, and they just take the streets over, and they have these routes that are in neighborhoods, and they have their lights on, and they have a great big social thing out of it. And so it's about looking at a full range of cycling, walking safely, making sure that traffic is routed the right way to make safe crossings, etc., and having a bus and transit system that overlays that helps connect people and, again, reduces those transportation costs as well as helping the environment.
One issue involving your city that, of course, has had a lot of national attention is HB2, which is known as the bathroom bill in shorthand. You're in a tough re-election fight right now, and that's become part of the campaign. There is a constituency in Charlotte and North Carolina that had concerns about what the Human Rights Commission had recommended originally for your policy. Is there a way that your original provision, which the bathroom bill was meant to combat, could have been rolled out to get greater, broader support and not prompted the state legislature to intervene?
First of all, I have to correct anyone who calls it what you just called it. It was a bill about discrimination or non-discrimination.
It is what it is commonly known as.
Exactly. But what it was, but the challenge is that people really think that was all it was about. And what it was about was Charlotte standing up to say, we don't believe discrimination against the LGBT community is right, and that we believe in public accommodations. You should have some ability to take a complaint to a local committee if you find you're discriminated against. We wanted our restaurants, our hotels, and our taxis to be inclusive, and by and large they are, but there are still isolated incidents of discrimination. So it was really all about non-discrimination for the LGBT community. The word bathroom was never in our original ordinance. It was in HB2. So I always want to correct folks on that. And in terms of could we work better with the state, we had a whole year of campaigns based around, because this was a vote that happened three times in the city of Charlotte. So it was two votes a year before I got elected mayor. And again, open, public, legislature knew about it. We had a whole year of campaigning, legislature knew about it. And we did not hear anything in looking at the 200 other cities across America that have non-discrimination ordinances, including Columbia, South Carolina, our neighbors to the south, Myrtle Beach, Atlanta, et cetera, many cities we compete with. We didn't hear anything from the legislature during that whole year about any retribution, any backlash that would happen. And so it was unexpected. And I think we did what we could in terms of projecting what we were going to do, talking about being an inclusive city. We will continue to express those values in Charlotte. We were very successful in still getting conventions and businesses, et cetera, coming to Charlotte because they knew that Charlotte was the city that stood up and said, we do not believe in discrimination. And so we had over 11,000 new jobs created in Charlotte, over 1,000 companies expanded or came to Charlotte in 2016, in spite of what the state did. And so we continue to express those values. We continue to talk about all the great things Charlotte has and all the ways that we do include and welcome folks. We are an incredibly diverse city, and we will continue to be that. We're working very closely with the private sector to do what we can within the constraints of what our state legislation has prohibited us from doing. But they did not monitor the private sector in that. So we are working very closely with them. We've always been a collaborative city. And we're going to continue to thrive and prosper based on being equal, inclusive, fostering innovation, celebrating creativity.
Let's take that a step further and expand it out to Capitol Hill and to the federal government and the relationship between the municipalities, Charlotte specifically, and the federal government. That's why you're here. You're in the capital. You're in the nation's capital. You're going to be on Capitol Hill soon. What is that relationship like, and what role can the federal government play when it comes to Charlotte being a smart city, improving infrastructure, and some of the other issues that you've brought up?
We actually have worked pretty well with our congressional delegation around a number of things. And one of the things that we're trying to get is a Doppler weather radar, which we don't have in Charlotte. I think we're the largest. I know we're the largest municipality doesn't have one. That we use South Carolina. And Robert Pittenger, who's a Republican congressman from our area, has helped to champion that. So we look at energy infrastructure and the things we've done around alternative energy, around energy conservation, et cetera. We've worked closely with Senator Burr on that. There are many things that we have actually had success with in our federal government. What we're interested in, specifically around infrastructure, is to continue some of the programs that have been so successful, like the Tiger Grants, so much that has supported transportation infrastructure. You know, we are a sort of non-traditional transit city. Unlike the older cities that have had transit for years, Charlotte was one of the first ones that wasn't a coastal city and wasn't one of the, you know, top 10 that had a very successful light rail development. And that was really based on the portion the federal government was able to fund. And that has spurred incredible private sector development. It has really been the leverage that we've used to get that collaboration to really grow our city in a smart way, in a way that's more effective and efficient and provides opportunity to more people. And so that's really where we're looking to the federal government, is to continue some of the successful programs that we have proven are successful, that we can point to the dollars that we've saved and the dollars we've generated based on that investment.
I wanted to ask a little bit about what reaction you would have to the Supreme Court's decision not to listen to the appeal to the lower court voter ID ruling last fall. That the plan that had been approved was called by the lower court an almost surgical precision attempt to disenfranchise African American voters. Looks like that law is not going to come back for the time being. How is that affecting voters in Charlotte?
That has a tremendous impact, and I have to say I was glad to see the Supreme Court's decision. And I actually looked very closely at that voter ID bill when it was first passed at our state, and I looked at where they made it harder for African Americans to vote and where there were districts that were packed, and that also our districts are unconstitutional, and so they are required to redraw our state legislative districts before next year's elections. They had to redraw the congressional districts as well. But if you look at the forms of ID, and they found the conversation that went on, they targeted forms of ID that African Americans don't have in the same proportion as white folks have. And that is distressing to people who want to have a voice in their government and who have also unfortunately seen decades of discrimination and earlier attempts to disenfranchise whole segments of our population. We are all about making sure everyone in Charlotte has a voice, that everyone feels empowered. We welcome citizen input all the time. We have a budgeting process where we put our budget online. We ask citizens to go in and show us what you would add or subtract. You know, how do you think it's impacts your neighborhood? Tell us what you feel. We have town hall meetings all over our city with all of our 11 district representatives on the city council, and I'm going to have one in June. We want people to feel like they are part of their future. And when you have a bill that is disenfranchising whole segments, that is not helpful. So we're glad to see the Supreme Court cares about that aspect of democracy.
Wanted to ask also about housing, part of the infrastructure issue. We talked a little bit with D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser about the issue of homelessness in the city, and she says that's a big part of her infrastructure plan. Is that a problem in Charlotte, and does that dovetail at all with the concept of a sanctuary city? I'm not sure if Charlotte is a sanctuary city at all.
Okay, two separate issues.
Okay.
So housing,
we can tease those apart completely.
Very good. So housing and affordable housing is a huge challenge.
Okay.
Because our rents are rising faster than wages. As our city grows, obviously property that's close in, that has a lesser commute, becomes much more valuable. And so what we are struggling with is about 34,000 units that we are short of affordable housing. And this is for our hourly workers, it's for our hotel workers, for our teachers, for our police officers, folks who are, you know, middle class, but in the lower level of that income bracket, and really trying to find a place that they can afford to live that's not 30 miles outside of the city. And so we are working very hard to increase the amount of money that we put into subsidized housing. Actually, we advocated to keep the community development block grants that are federal grants that we've used for housing projects. And so whether it is new housing, whether it is renovating existing homes so seniors can stay in their homes and not get gentrified out of their neighborhood, so they can do those essential repairs, et cetera, we advocated to keep those, and they're in the current budget. We hope they're in fiscal year 18 as well. So that's something where the federal government has been very helpful in our housing situation. One of the challenges we have is that we are not allowed to require a new construction a certain percentage to be affordable. So even though we're doing more mixed-income housing, it's voluntary. We encourage it. We try to work with developers to do it. We try to show how it benefits everyone. But again, we have to help subsidize with public money to really get it to happen at the speed that we need. So that's a challenge. Housing continues to be a challenge, but we've got some great projects underway. On the sanctuary city issue, that is an immigration issue.
Okay.
And that is really cities that are trying to not defy federal law, but to limit federal reach in terms of their communities in deportations. We are not a sanctuary city. We are a welcoming city. We have many immigrants, but we also have a 287G program, which is a federal program that allows local sheriff's deputies to actually start deportation proceedings for folks. Now, they only encounter that program if they're arrested for some kind of offense. And so it is really targeting violent criminals. Sometimes we're concerned that it's not necessarily targeting violent criminals. We don't want it used for traffic incidents, that sort of thing. But we do want to be a city that supports immigrants. We have an immigrant integration task force that's looking at how do we support immigrant small business, how do we help more legal residents become citizens. That's something that we're actively working with some nonprofits to encourage, because then you have the full rights and privileges of citizenship. And sometimes the housing and the immigrant issue do overlap when immigrants are part of that that lower income or hourly workforce that has a hard time finding housing. But they're really two separate issues.
Yeah. My final question for you, Mayor Roberts, deals with some of the divisions that we see in politics today. If you are looking at North Carolina from a national stage, you see cities like Charlotte that are heavily Democratic, college towns, of course, your Raleigh-Durhams, those tend to be blue, and then there's these seas of deep red all over the state. Now, in North Carolina, that combines to make the whole thing pretty purple, pretty competitive, and I'm sure you'll have no shortage of presidential attention in 2020. But in the meantime, as the mayor of a major city, is there something you can do within your own state, your own region, to sort of bridge some of these political divides that we see between demographic groups, urban-rural, the divisions we see in politics today?
Well, the first thing to remember is that we have gerrymandering that, again, has been declared unconstitutional in our state. And so the first thing I'm doing is advocating very strongly for an independent redistricting commission. And there are actually bills in the House and Senate that would support that, but they haven't gotten out of committee. We're hoping that that is going to change before 2020, the next census. But that is a challenge, because what we find is that even though we're very purple, the state as a whole is about 50-50 in terms of registrations. We have 10 Republican and 3 Democratic congressional representatives. So, and that is also mirrored in our state House and Senate. It's a veto-proof majority. So what we find is that redistricting with an independent commission would help restore balance. So that's one of the first things I'm doing. But the second thing I want to do is help bridge the rural-urban divide. And what we find is a lot of the legislatures now in conservative areas are from rural districts. We want them to prosper, too. We want to make sure that our city is connecting to those rural areas around us, and we have a whole farm-to-fork movement so that we have fancy restaurants in Charlotte that pick local farms and highlight them and talk about them on their menu and really help them survive and help them be publicized as part of supporting that rural area that is just outside our borders. We have farmers markets that do the same thing. We have some tourist attractions in surrounding areas that are in rural areas where a lot of people from Charlotte go and spend money and spend time. We want to continue to build and looking at ourselves as a region and look at economic development as a region. And so even if there's a large company that wants to create a new factory or a new manufacturing facility, we want them to look regionally. And there's a whole regional partnership that markets us that way, because sometimes they don't fit in a very densely developed Charlotte, but they might fit across the border. And we know, again, they're going to live, they're going to shop, they're going to entertain in Charlotte. Everybody's going to benefit. So we want to continue to do that. One thing I did recently is we have a regional coalition of mayors, some very small towns along with Charlotte and some bigger towns. I gave them all a tour of our airport. It's a regional facility. They got the behind-the-scenes tour of all the construction and the growth that we have at our airport, and they saw how things worked, and that helped them feel like this is part of their growth. It's an asset they use all the time. We want them to feel included.
We are at the Bloomberg Smart Cities meeting with many mayors, including Mayor John Mitchell of New Bedford, Massachusetts, the state's sixth largest city, part of the Providence metropolitan statistical area, but definitely a place with its own spirit and soul. You come from a longtime fishing family.
I do, as a matter of fact. Yes, my parents are public school teachers, but my family, especially on my father's side, was in the commercial fishing industry, which is a big thing in New Bedford. We're the largest commercial fishing port in America, and are growing in terms of market share. A lot of the fishing industry on the East Coast is actually gravitating toward New Bedford, so it's a big part of not only our regional economy but also a big part of our culture.
You also have a large manufacturing presence, and you're here learning about smart cities and infrastructure issues. As you are trying to harness big data and information toward improving your city, how does that interface with some of the workforce challenges you have in an inevitably transitioning economy?
Yeah, so things are complex right now, and you know, we're in a sort of a unique situation, at least for us, in the sense that our unemployment rate has dropped precipitously. Labor participation has gone up, but we still have sort of a pesky cohort of folks who remain outside the labor market. And the lament of most employers these days is, I am hiring up. I've got help wanted signs, which is a rare sight in New Bedford historically, but I can't find the people who have the basic math and English skills, and even more importantly, soft skills to do the job. So you know, what we're trying to do is to deal with that is, among other things, to enhance our transportation infrastructure. We believe that as other mayors do, facilitating the ability of people to go from home to their place of employment. Yeah, it makes us more competitive. I'm sort of to state the obvious, but you know, what we've tried to do is integrate smart cities technology, sensors, and other data gathering measures into our transportation system to allow us to figure out where people are living, where migration patterns are heading, and where the employment growth is, so that we can adjust on the fly.
Data with context is knowledge. When you are able to apply that knowledge, then you can move on to the next step. What would the next step be, and does the federal government or maybe the private sector have a role in that?
Well, the private sector, I think, does have a role in helping identify their needs. And so I think these days, just given apparent backing off of the federal government from the life of the cities in this country, at least that's, I think, what we should assume until it's proven otherwise, and the continuing resource constraints at the local level, you know, more has to be expected of the private sector. So not only in the way of identifying needs, but also ponying up funding to actually activate projects that might be in the public good, whether they are, in our case, port facilities, or whether they are surface transportation projects, whatever it is. But you know, what we try to do is work hand in glove with business so that you know, we have a sense of where their needs are, not just presently, but you know, a year from now, 5 years from now, and so forth.
Your city has the highest bond rating ever in its history, which is saying something when it starts in the 17th century. How does smart city innovation play into that?
Yeah, I don't think S&P was around back then, so it may not be a valid marker. But in any event, we are. Even though we're 2017 and not 2008 anymore, we still manage city government with an air of austerity, as though it were 2008. In the sense that we're not parsimonious about every last penny. We do look for opportunities to invest, but we've got to get more efficient all the time because we still are resource constrained. So we have championed a number of efficiency initiatives that have freed up capital, public capital, to invest in critical infrastructure, whether it's broadband, whether it's port facilities, and so forth. And we do that by being more data-driven. When I got into office, there was nothing in the way of a performance management mechanism in city government. We have one now. We measure all the things that I think, at least for now, that are relevant to our continuing to deliver important services, but also to save taxpayer dollars. And we've also seized opportunities for in certain discrete areas. Energy is a good example, where we've been very aggressive in building out our solar capacity. According to the Wall Street Journal, we have more installed municipal solar capacity than any city in the United States. Actually, in the continental United States, Honolulu has, we're told, more installed capacity per capita, but obviously Honolulu has a slight
advantage
when it comes to sun. So, yeah. So, but anyway, it's just one example of the kinds of energy, the kinds of initiatives that we've been aggressively pursuing. Because, you know, when you step back and think about our position, New Bedford's a city of 100,000. It's an older industrial city, and even though we've seen a lot of growth of late, we're one of these places that historically has lag behind the business cycle, right? We're usually late to emerge from a recession and quick to go back into the next one. And what I'm trying to do is to make the right kinds of adjustments along the way and the right kinds of investments that allow us to flatten that out and remain on a steadier growth trajectory.
Being in an event like this one with the Smart Cities event and the other mayors in the nation's capital and the other things that you guys are going to be doing today, do you find that you are providing some best practices to other mayors, or you're able to take away best practices from them? And I ask that because everybody else has been talking about housing and infrastructure as far as transportation. You're the first one I've talked to who's talked about solar energy and renewable energy.
Yeah, so we try to... through organizations like the U.S. Conference of Mayors and others, try to share ideas. And I think there is, you know, there's this mindset that I think has taken hold among the nation's mayors that is all about self-sufficiency and not, you know, waiting for the federal government to initiate something new, whether it's investment, whether it's new social programs, because I think there is, at some among most mayors, some level of skepticism that the federal government's actually going to deliver. And I think that skepticism is probably pretty well founded. And so what we've done, and certainly I do this in my city, is try to preach an ethic of self-sufficiency. We're going to, you know, determine our own fate. And yeah, we might need to have a good partnership with the state and federal government. But at the end of the day, it's a partnership, but we're driving the action.
You were talking about 2008. Would like to take a moment to talk about 2007. March was the 10-year anniversary of the immigration raid that netted 361 textile workers and the people who hired them. How did that change the city, and what did it learn from the experience?
Yeah, so that was the so-called Michael Bianco raid, which Michael Bianco was a factory in the south end of our city that made rucksacks for the Department of Defense, and it employed a large number of undocumented workers. The ICE went in, and as part in connection with a criminal investigation of the employers of the bosses, as it were, rounded up a very large number of the workers who didn't have immigration status. And it was a shock, I think, not only to the city, for I think obvious reasons, sort of the disruption in folks' in the lives of not only the workers but their families, including the school children, was something that people don't forget. But I think it also, at least through the end of the Bush administration and the Obama administration, changed the way that immigration law is enforced in this country. That was perhaps the last of the large immigration raids in the country until whatever happens next now. And I think so we do continue to have a large undocumented worker population, especially in our fish houses. Not only are we the largest commercial fishing port, we also have the largest fish processing base in the country, and our fish processors do employ a number of undocumented workers. So there are a lot of folks who are on edge about what might happen next. Will there be a return to Michael Bianco style enforcement? And so, you know, what we've tried to do, you know, we are not a sanctuary city, because I think I've taken the position that because that term is undefined in federal law, and because there's no sort of settled definition, that by taking a hard position, we're only inflaming the division that we're seeing in lots of cities around the country. And, you know, frankly, as a leader of my city, I don't want that to be a distraction to all the hard work we're doing. All that said, we take pains to help folks in our community know what their legal rights are. We take pains to remind folks what a welcoming city New Bedford is, and we're a place that has been traditionally hospitable to new immigrants wherever they're from, and we'll continue to approach it that way.
Then we've looked at 2008, we've looked at 2007. Let's look at 2027. What's your city going to look like in the next 10 years?
Yeah, great question. So what I hope for my city is that, you know, we continue to cement our status as the not only the center of the southern part of Massachusetts, but one of the leading cities in the Northeast that has a more diversified economy, that is a place that people are moving into because the school system has gotten a lot better and doing right by children, and is a place that is competitive and continues to be competitive in maritime industries because that's our bread and butter. Our port is the reason why New Bedford exists and why it'll continue to exist in the years ahead. That will be a leader not only in fishing but in offshore wind, which is the next big industry for us. It's all coming to the United States in the years ahead. And that we have a more knowledge-based economy, that we're one of these places in the Northeast that doesn't have much of a tech sector, but we're starting to develop the seeds of one now, and where we hope is that we're banking on the idea that technology companies can take root anywhere. It doesn't have to be in East Cambridge or in Palo Alto. It can be in places like New Bedford that are a place where ideas can be freely exchanged and where people can have a high quality of life and grow their business. So that's the idea for us. I think we're making progress in that direction.
And because we don't know how this is all going to be edited, I will ask, and about 2018 and 2020, you are a Democratic mayor of a working class city. You have a Harvard degree, but you worked your way through school in the factories and the warehouses. How does a Democrat connect with working class voters? It's a big question being asked in Washington these days.
Yeah, I think mayors, Democratic mayors, have a pretty good handle on that because I include myself in this mix because, we don't have the luxury of being ideological, or at least overtly ideological, and we don't have the luxury of being partisan. We have to get stuff done. And so the way I look at it is if people want the same things regardless of their political stripe, they really, as mundane as it might sound, they want their streets plowed, they want their kids to go to a good school, they want their block to be safe, and Democrat or Republican, if you're delivering on that, you will gain the respect and the goodwill of folks. That's the way I approach it, which is decidedly nonpartisan. It's more executive, and I think that's what's attractive to me about my job, and I suspect it's true of a lot of other mayors around the country. People are demanding results, and as mayor, you're in a position to do that if that's truly your focus.
All right. John Mitchell, the mayor of New Bedford, Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Alan. Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.